Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 62. The Meeting of Usha and Aniruddha. Text 9. Thus advised, unintelligent Banasura was delighted. The fool then went home, O king, to wait for that which Lord Ganesha had predicted, the destruction of his prowess. Purport. Here, Banasura is described as Kudi, having bad intelligence, and Kumati, foolish, because he completely misunderstood the actual situation. The demon was so arrogant that he was convinced no one could defeat him. He was delighted to hear that someone as powerful as Lord Shiva would come to fight with him and satisfy his itching for battle. Even though Lord Shiva had said that this person would break Bana's flag and destroy his prowess, the demon was too foolish to take this statement seriously and eagerly awaited the fight. At the present moment, materialistic people are delighted by the many unprecedented facilities for sense gratification. Although it is clear that death, both individual and collective, is quickly approaching them, modern sense gratifiers are oblivious to their inevitable destruction. As stated in the Bhagavatam, Pashyannapi na pashyati. Even though their imminent destruction is apparent, they are too blind to see it, being intoxicated by sex enjoyment and family attachment. Similarly, Banasura was intoxicated with his material prowess and could not believe that he was about to be cut down to size. Om Gyana Chimanandasya Gyananjana Shalakya Chakshu Militan Yena Tasmai Sri Guru Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Jai Tanya Buddhananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. This is a very mysterious incident in Srimad Bhagavatam, because it's going to involve, eventually, a fight between Lord Shiva and Lord Krishna. The immediate cause is Banasura, who, from the material point of view, isn't a bad guy. He was famous for his charity, for his integrity. He always kept his word of honor. He was gentlemanly. And he was the son of Bali Maharaj, the oldest son of Bali Maharaj, who's one of the Mahajans, the 12 authorities in devotional service. As you know, Bali Maharaj surrendered everything to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the Lord became his doorman. So, Banasura was Bali's eldest of the 100 sons. And Banasura was a Kshatriya with dignity, honor, charity. But you see, if you have a problem with Krishna, then all your good qualities are nullified. Sometimes people wonder, why don't we give credit to non-devotees? Why don't we recognize persons with material prowess? The problem is that as devotees of Lord Krishna, we know that without bhakti, without devotional service to Krishna, all the apparent good things about a person are just temporary flickerings. And that's why we don't attribute any value to such opulences or abilities. Just like everyone knows the beauty of a Hollywood or Bollywood movie star. How long is it going to last? If you ever have the chance to look at pictures of great movie stars when they're past their prime and in old age, then you would see the real secrets of beauty. They're all withered dried up. So, no one cares them anymore. After 10 or 20 years of stardom, no one cares. we understand this to be true with all material assets, all material abilities. It is only when our abilities and assets are in contact with Krishna that they have any real value. Otherwise, you know the example, a string of zeros. You may have so many zeros, but without the Supreme One, there's no value to a string of zeros. So first, I want you to understand that Banasura, compared to a person today, was a very great gentleman. His only problem was he did not understand Krishna. And that led him to a stance which was the cause of his undoing. He had successfully pleased Lord Shiva. And therefore, Lord Shiva had given him the benediction that he would have 1,000 arms. And with those 1,000 arms, he happened to play drums while Lord Shiva danced. Lord Shiva is famous for his dancing, Shiva Nataraj. And again, Banasura pleased Lord Shiva, who, as you know, is Ashutosh, easy to please and also easy to anger. So, Lord Shiva asked him, "Well, what benediction do you want now?" And Banasura then revealed his real inner workings. Despite all the apparent Kshatriya integrity and valor and charity, despite the well-manneredness of his exterior, in his heart, he harbored desires simply to gratify his senses. This destroys all good qualities again and again. That's why bhakti yoga gets to the root of the problem. Who gets the sense gratification? Bhakti yoga is not against sense gratification. It just recognizes that the sense gratification goes to Krishna. There must be sense gratification because Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has senses. The only question is, who should get it? So often in speaking with devotees, I explain that you should not have anxiety, you should not fear that there's no sense gratification in Krishna consciousness. Bhakti yoga is full of sense gratification for Krishna senses, and that is the central issue. At the core of Banasura was this problem. What to do with my senses? Sense gratification is for me. He had 1,000 arms. And he confessed to Lord Shiva. When Lord Shiva asked him, "What benediction do you want?" He said, "You know, actually, having 1,000 arms wasn't as, wasn't an easy thing as I thought. I got 1,000 arms and they're all itching all the time. Yeah, I want to fight. I don't know what to do with these 1,000 arms. If I try to fight someone, you know, he's a Kshatriya, he's got the Ishwar Bhav. Kshatriyas like to fight. But he said, every time I try to fight someone, they run away from me because I got 1,000 arms. Who can fight me? Battles between Kshatriyas are supposed to be fair, but how do you fight with someone with 1,000 arms? So Banasura knew that, and this was his great lamentation. What do I do with all the strength I've got? And then he actually subtly implied to Lord Shiva, since I can't meet anyone who will satisfy my urge to fight and relieve me of this itching in my 1,000 arms, probably you're the only one. So he subtly implied to Lord Shiva that I should fight you and I'll defeat you. This is the problem that lust and pride go closely together. Because in order to be lusty, what you're actually doing, consciously or unconsciously, is asserting yourself as the supreme enjoyer. You're asserting yourself in separation from Krishna. I can bring myself happiness, and I can bring others happiness. So Banasura was asserting himself in that way, very subtly, that, well, I have to satisfy myself. I got these 1,000 arms. I guess I have to fight with the very person who gave me the benedictions, my Lord Shiva. In other words, somewhere or other, you've got to get satisfaction. This is the material principle that you see so blatant today. Somehow or other, you have a right to satisfy your senses. Even if it means Banasura is fighting with his worshipable Lord, his Ishtadev, Lord Shiva. That's how the contemporary person would see this. Well, what can Banasura do? He's got this itching in 1,000 arms. No one could relieve that itching. So, therefore, he turned on Lord Shiva in a subtle way. Very eloquently done. Not directly, he didn't say Lord Shiva like Spike. He just gave the implications that since there's no one else around, I guess you're going to have to fit the bill. So, Lord Shiva was angry. And actually, the Acharyas say that Lord Shiva considered killing him. But then he thought, how can I kill my own servant? He's done so much to try to please me. All right. He'll be good. He'll be good material for Krishna to fight with. So Lord Shiva said, you asked for a benediction for what to do with your 1,000 arms. You told me that you're so restless and itching that with these 1,000 arms you smash mountains. Reducing them to powder. But someone is going to come who will exhaust all your fighting energies. Someone will come who will be a suitable match for you, and you'll actually be defeated. You'll be vanquished. All your energies will be spent. Now, yeah, to appreciate Banasura's reaction, you need to understand, first of all, the Ishvara Bhava of a Kshatriya. They like to fight. They like battle. They like competition. And you also have to understand that Banasura, blinded by his abilities, was becoming quite foolish. This is such a problem. Every time we get a little ability, a little accomplishment, a little achievement, we become blinded by pride. So, Banasura actually couldn't even hear Lord Shiva properly. He thought, Lord Shiva means that I'm going to meet someone who's going to really let me use my prowess and vent my fighting abilities. He didn't so much pay attention to the part where Lord Shiva said, you're going to be defeated. That person's going to crush you in battle. Because actually, with pride, Banasura is thinking, hey, who can defeat me anyway? What Lord Shiva actually means is it's going to be a good fight. I'm going to enjoy it. It'll be kind of like a cliffhanger. It may seem like I'm going to lose, but in the end, after exhausting all my fighting prowess, I'll still be victorious because actually I am victory. He was thinking like that. He couldn't hear straight due to pride. A further psychological point, very interesting. Srila Prabhupada makes this in the Krishna book. Gives you deep insight. Because you're wondering, what makes this Banasura tick? Got 1,000 arms, and he's in such anxiety because of it. What's really going on in his head? So Srila Prabhupada points out that what's going on in Banasura's head is something typical of all materialists. That they actually like to expend themselves. They like to just let it all out, get it all off their chest. And even they're left exhausted. It gives them a kind of good feeling. It's a material tendency, material psychology, which may elude us in understanding. But think. In Kali Yuga culture, I know it doesn't happen here in Durban, but in Kali Yuga culture, yeah. On the weekends, what do people do? What do they do? They party. And they even, with their own words, what do they say happens to them? They get wasted. They use that term here too? They drink, or even worse, they take drugs. They engage in all sorts of abominable activities. And then they're completely exhausted. And they feel good about it. When they drink, they get a hangover the next day. But they don't care because they exhausted all their energies in partying. This happens too in Durban. I always tell the story how I was speaking at the University of Manchester in the UK to a room full of students, future doctors, engineers, lawyers. And so I asked, what is it that you do when Friday comes? And they all looked at me like I was from another planet. Like, how could you ask such a question? What do we do when Friday comes? Don't you know? I said, please, please explain to me. You're all intelligent, future doctors, lawyers, engineers. What do you do when Friday comes? When Friday comes, we get wasted. I said, well then, how do you feel the next day? And they say, oh, we feel, you know, we got a headache, you feel miserable. But it was all worth it just to have a few hours on Friday. They told me it was all worth it. Because you had a few hours of just letting it all out, just exerting yourself. So what if you're miserable the next day? At least you had a chance to just get it all out. Party. Passion. And then one well-mannered lady student, she said to me, and you know what is the most amazing thing? The most amazing thing is after you party Friday and you're completely wasted, and you wake up on Saturday morning and there's someone next to you and you don't know how that person got there. And all the students said, yeah! And on Monday you tell all your friends and you kind of mock embarrassment. Oh, I woke up Saturday morning and there was this guy there. I didn't know how we got here. So I hope then you can understand Banasura psychology. He's got 1,000 arms. The point is these 1,000 arms are itching. He's itching to fight. Maybe you've met persons like that who just are itching to fight. There's so many itches, but they basically are all just motive passion. Itch to make money. Itch to play sports, to defeat others, compete. And of course, the lust itch. So Banasura had 1,000 arms. He thought that 1,000 arms would be the source of his satisfaction, but now he's realizing these 1,000 arms are a burden. Just like lusty desires. The fool thinks they're a great benediction. They all go around saying, if there's a God, he gave us lust to enjoy. So why should we try to control it? It's God's gift to us. Just let it all out, this way, that way. And what is the sane understanding? What is the clear understanding that Bhagavad Dharma gives us? That lust is a curse. It's a disease. It's the manifestation of sinful reactions. And it's something to be medically treated. Treated through the process of bhakti yoga. You don't wallow in it. You don't indulge in it. You recognize it as an enemy. People today have such a hard time swallowing that. Lust an enemy? It's what life's all about. No, it is a problem. Indeed, Prahlad Maharaj says, just like Banasura, for example, is feeling the itch in 1,000 arms, Prahlad Maharaj says that the lust desire is an itch. Yan maitunari griha meri sukam hiducham. Kanduyanena kavayo ibaduka dukam. Those who are not properly situated think that there's such a future, there's so much pleasure in lusty affairs. But Prahlad Maharaj says, sukham hiducham. Certainly the so-called pleasure there is so insignificant. There's a little something, but it's just so insignificant. It's just also insignificant. Why? In other words, they're making such a big deal out of it. Sukham hiducham. Certainly. So insignificant. Just like if there was a drop of water on this table and I was thirsty, you would point to that drop and say, yeah, there's water there, what's the problem? You're right, factually speaking, there is water there. But will that drop of water satisfy me? No, I need a whole cup of water. a good doctor will tell you, you should drink at least 2 liters of water a day. But there's just one drop of water there. I say it's mobile phone torture time. There's one drop of water there. I need water. And you can point out and say, you have water. What's the problem? But, of course, you know. It's so insignificant. It's not even worth talking about. So that's Prahlad Maharaj's point about this apparently all-devouring monster of lust. Insignificant happiness. Not worth even talking about. Kanduyanena kavayo ivadukadukam. He gives a very graphic example. It's like rubbing two hands together to relieve an itch. You ever got a mosquito bite on your hand? That ever happened to you? It can really be annoying because, you know, parts of the hands are very sensitive. Especially the mosquitoes that have to go for the blood veins right there. Or on your wrist. It's a real pain in the, you know, it's a real irritated, you know? So, Prahlad Maharaj says, that's what the whole phenomenon is about. Tripyanti neha kripana bahudukaba. The fools, kripana, misers, they're squandering their intelligence of the human moral life. They never are satisfied. Tripyanti neha, never satisfied. Just like Banasura, 1,000 arms, never satisfied. He didn't know what to do with that itch of 1,000 arms. Kandutivan manasidam vishahita dira. Therefore, those who are dira, actually intelligent, they tolerate the itch and they avoid so much suffering. This is what modern society has no idea. Therefore, we say there's no real culture, there's no real civilization. Real civilization begins with kandutivan manasidam vishahita dira, teaching people how to tolerate, how to purify that disease. And then there can be real freedom. So Banasura is admitting, I'm imprisoned by this itching desire in 1,000 arms. I just want to vent that energy. And when I feel exhausted, wasted, then I'll be happy. He never actually considered that he would really be defeated, because who could defeat him? But he's thinking, I'll have such a good fight. It'll be like I'm defeated. And I'll be completely exhausted. My energies will be vented completely. That's what he was focusing on. Just that feeling. I'll have that feeling of just... This is a mode of passion. So, he waited for that day when the benediction, Lord Shiva, Girisha, gave him, when it would come, the so-called, he felt, the so-called destruction of my prowess. Lord Shiva said, destruction of my prowess, but we know it'll just be a good fight. There are a lot of lessons for us to learn from this. We should see how foolish we can become, that we'll sacrifice our well-being, sacrifice our spiritual development just to vent some desires. we don't understand that by certain kinds of behavior, the intelligence becomes blinded. Our intelligence becomes lost. There's a certain intoxication that comes about by gratifying our senses, and that intoxication causes our intelligence to become murky, and we can't see our own life clearly enough. Sometimes devotees have a difficult time with this because they think that the main thing is that I believe in Krishna. Because I believe in Krishna, my intelligence will be clear no matter what I do, more or less, you know. Because I'm a devotee, I can make some infractions, I can slacken a bit, but still, my buddhi will be intact, my buddhi yoga will be there, because I'm a devotee, I believe in Krishna. In Kali Yuga, it's often hard for people to understand that their activities directly affect what they can perceive, the level of their intelligence, in terms of understanding spiritual subject matter. Therefore, devotees are very careful to protect the treasure of their spiritual intelligence, which is the gift from the struggle to be Krishna conscious. Krishna blesses you with intelligence to see how things are going on. Eventually, Krishna says he'll talk to you and give you personalized instructions how to go back to Godhead. Te sham sattayuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayanti. So, the bhakti yoga is a lifestyle. It's not a belief system. You may believe this way or that way, but if you engage in Krishna conscious activities, your consciousness will change. Just like, never mind what you think about fire. If you stick your hand in the fire, it's going to burn you. Therefore, a devotee is very, very conscientious about the activities that he or she does. And we don't want to be fooled by the itching in the thousand arms, like Banasura. He just thought, give me relief, just let me get it all out. Be done with it. And he was done. Be done with it. Turned out to mean that he was done. He was finished. So there are some very important psychological lessons that we can learn from Banasura, especially remembering that from many points of view, he was a gentleman, integrity, character. The problem was, though, he didn't know how to use his energies in Krishna's service. Then you have Arjuna. He was extraordinarily powerful, but he used everything for Krishna's pleasure, Krishna's gratification. That is the story of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna fought completely for Krishna's pleasure, whereas Banasura wanted to fight for his own pleasure. Therefore, he's bewildered by his great strength. Historically, you see this bewilderment happen all the time. People, nations, various groups accumulate vast resources and don't know what to do with them. And they become expended through wars, through revolutions, through corruption. Just like on the African continent, so much natural resources, diamonds, mineral ores, so much is there. Oil in some parts of the African continent. No one knows what to do with it. The resources are so plundered that all these the stocks of the resources, diamonds or oil, for the next 10 or 20 years are already sold off. And it hasn't even come out of the ground yet. It's sold off in futures. So, people don't know how to use these resources. They don't know how to use the resource of their human form of life. They don't know how to use the resources of nature. And even they're told climate change, problems from nature, they can't really turn the ship around. They can't adjust quickly enough because they're always fearing. We don't want any reduction in our sense gratification. Yes, let there be ecological thinking, let there be environmental consciousness, but don't touch my sense gratification. They haven't figured things out yet. Let there be green this, green that, alternative energy, clean up the air, clean up the rivers, but don't stop anyone from gratifying your sense. But you see, here's the paradox. As soon as you try to gratify your senses, you become covered with pride, you become bewildered, and you can't live properly. So you can't have it both ways. I'll have, you know, all the sense gratification, and I'll have intelligence. It just doesn't work, and it's hard for people to accept this point. Unless they learn the art of focusing on Krishna's sense gratification, then the whole mystery becomes clear. Then, indeed, so to speak, you see the light. Ah, now I understand what sense gratification is meant for. So that is why we have our devotional service community. It's not a religious faith community. It's not a community of believers. It's a community of bhakti activists who, with their senses, are eager to engage in Krishna's service for Krishna's pleasure. And then there is peace, then there is intelligence, then there can be prosperity. But let us not become bewildered with the resources of our life, no matter how big or small those resources are. You have some years ahead of you in life, that's a resource. You have some physical strength, you have some intellectual capacity, that's all resource. Now what are you going to do with it? Should you think, ah, oh, I've got so much energy, particularly if you're in, you know, your 20s, you have this feeling. When you're in your teen, you can remember when you were a teenager, it was even worse. You didn't know what to do with yourself when you were a teenager. Very embarrassing stage of life, being a teenager. No one likes to admit their teenage craziness they did. And you try to, you know, the embarrassing things you did because you couldn't handle all the energy that was flowing through you. In this way, please be a little sympathetic with Banasura. Note that when the mode of passion may attack you, you'll feel like Banasura felt. What am I going to do? And then you start changing the philosophy. Well, Krishna understands. He knows I've got 1,000 arms and they're itching. He understands. I'll just vent it all out. I'll just get it all out. And then I'll be able to serve Krishna more determinedly. No. The secret of bhakti yoga is to learn from Krishna how to use your senses for Krishna's pleasure. Then there's peace. Then there's clarity. But to get that peace and clarity and true happiness, we need devotional service. The more Krishna sees your devotional service appetite, the more he reciprocates with you. So that is what bhakti is about. All right, we'll stop here and ask you any questions. Yes.
Well, thanks very much, Maharaj. I want to say, for lack of a better word, you know, your exposition was successful. Now, I want to reflect on this Thursday's lecture, one of the activities, set interesting like observation, and he said, in India, in most of the holy cities in India, there's an emergence of McDonald's establishments.
Emergence of?
McDonald's establishments.
McDonald's.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So it's like McDonald's are not only like meat eating, but promoting like entities. They are also venturing into property. So wherever they go, they acquire property, and they also promote it, meat eating.
Yes, because for McDonald's or any big fast food chain, they actually say they're not in the food business, they're in the property business. buy a property in a at a prime location, and yeah, make some money off of selling food. But the real thing is, watch the property values. They need good properties in order to sell the food, and also they like to have properties in the center of cities or prime spots in the suburbs, because the property values may increase and they'll make more money that way off selling the property than they will off of, you know, hamburgers. So they get it both ways. Yes.
So my second observation is that the companies are very vigorous in their actions to spread the word.
Yes.
You can see that in now that the genetically modified foods are being promoted.
Yes.
So my concern is, scripture consciousness. Or let me also say that, according to one conspiracy theorist, 60% of food producing seeds are already patented. In other words, they are legally owned by individuals.
Oh, you're into all this, huh?
So it's like, I'm very much concerned. I mean, with the activity, with the amount of energy the companies are putting into their activities.
Oh yes, it's Monsanto. They, you know, it's on record. They had a corporate strategy, how to control the world's food supply, how to have a monopoly. Everyone has to eat. So if you want to make money, you know, if you're an Asura and you're simply thinking money, wouldn't it be the most brilliant thing to control the world's food supply? Wouldn't you do that if you were a demon? How could you lose? Everyone has to eat. First, you get everyone to try and eat the same way, no matter what their culture is. Get everyone into Big Macs, McDonald's. I don't know in India yet if McDonald's is serving cow's flesh. Generally what they do is they instead of cow's meat, they substitute lamb's meat. They call it, instead of the Big Mac in India, they call it the Maharaj Burger. You know, preaching according to time and place. So, the first thing is to get everyone to eat the same way, because that's much better for your business. Rather than having to deal with all different styles of eating, North Indian, South Indian, Bengali, let's speak of the rest of the world. If you just get everyone to be attracted to the same diet, you can do quantity sales. And, you know, 5 billion people all want Big Macs, you know, more, instead of their ethnic food. It's you can do bigger volume sales, reduce your productivity costs. So they're thinking like that, first of all. Then the second thing is you can control the world's food supply by controlling the agricultural resources. So that's what Monsanto is thinking. And they actually, you know, they have corporate meetings about that.
And we have one example just next to us. It's a so that's Umhlanga and the Mount Ashcombe and the rest. We had sugarcane plantations over there, but now they are getting destroyed. And they push luxurious houses are being erected. So what's going to happen is they will move the sugarcane plantations to the poor African countries. And even there, the very same people who have been owning land here in the north of Devon are the ones going to like owning those places over there. So they're going to kind of like manipulating both land for production of agricultural plants and for property. So now my concern
Well, if you're a demon, isn't that the way to go?
My question is, Maharaj, as Krishna consciousness, are we actually doing enough to like stop them from further advancing and conquering the world?
What do you suggest we do?
Anyway,
I'm asking, what do you suggest we do? You sound like me in my doing my university days. What are we supposed to do?
So I've got this observation with my observation is much like motivated by my first experience. I was in Soweto over the weekend, and it's like I was looking at the number of people who attended the festival. So I was trying to contest it as against a picture I saw on the internet of some 2 weeks ago of some festival that was taking place in India. There were approximately about 5,000 people on the street. Mm-hmm. So I was contesting the two, and I wanted to know if is Krishna consciousness, are we like, most basically in Africa, are we doing enough today to promote the well-being of the human
nature? Doing enough for?
To promote the well-being of the human nature.
Promoting what?
The well-being of the human
well-being.
Yeah.
Of course, everything we're doing is for the topmost well-being of the human being.
Is it enough?
We're not doing enough, though. We need to get people to chant Hare Krishna more and read Srila Prabhupada's books. That is the only solution. I went through all this during my university years. I had the best teachers, the teachers who write the books that are used in universities all over the world. And I went through this back and forth. Unless you teach people how to control their senses, who they are, and what they are part of. In other words, they are spirit, soul, part of Krishna, supreme soul. Unless you teach them that, there is no political economic solution. In my university days, I studied all about African history. In fact, one of the teachers I took a course from, African history, he has written the definitive history of South Africa, Leonard Thompson. And what's his name? Desmond Tutu said, this is the best history of South Africa. So I studied. I took his classes. So I went through it back and forth. Not only Africa, all parts of the world. And again and again, I could see there is no political solution. You just redistribute the political power, and what happens? Because people can't control their senses, because they're godless, because they don't know their spiritual identity, they just make the same mistakes all over again. I studied revolutions, I studied political theory, this or that and the other. And I saw that the only solution is spiritual. And unless you can give people a spiritual lifestyle, they must exploit. They don't have any higher vision. Just like Banasura doesn't have any higher vision, even though he actually has some good qualities. So there has to be a problem. But therefore, if you really want to make a change, then you have to be the change. It's very easy to spout political theories, down with this group, down with that, kick out those guys, give the power to us. Very easy to do that. But to learn how to control your own senses? Well, right, what happens when Friday night comes? Where was I speaking? Oh, in London last week. I think you were there. Remember I told about the revolutionary students gathering? Yeah. You know, this is my first year at Yale, you know, before I just got tired of politics. You know, we had the revolutionary students planning session. At that time, Yale was just all men. So, you know, they had to bring in girls from the prestige girls' schools, you know, for a weekend, you know. So they're going to have a revolutionary weekend. And, of course, a main part of the revolutionary weekend was to invite the girls from the girls' schools, you know. Because what revolution is complete without? So we had a plan making session. You know, 100, you know, revolutionary students were there. You know, we're going to have seminars, workshops on colonialism, exploitation, economic oppression, political disenfranchisement. All these words, you know, you heard them all, right? We're going to have workshops. We're going to have tours through the low-income parts of the city so the students can identify and... Oh, they went. For the community, for the people. And then at the end of the two-hour planning session, one of the coordinators stood up and said, okay, and now the moment you're all waiting for. Yeah. After the seminars during the day and the tour through the community, it's party time. And I want you to be honest. Brothers and sisters, I want you to be honest. Just brothers or any sisters. Brothers, I want you to be honest. If 2 o'clock comes around, 2 o'clock in the morning, and you failed, meaning, he said, you haven't made your way to a motel room with a fine revolutionary sister, then why don't you just be humble? Come on back and clean up the dance floor. I said, oh my goodness. Forget this. That was it. I just walked out. I said, oh, forget this politics. And some of those students who were there, they're big leaders today. One's a mayor of Baltimore, the big city in USA, the big corporate leaders. But, you know, after all is said and done, that's the conclusion. So I said, forget this stuff. There has to be a deeper, more penetrating analysis. I studied African history, African literature, all the famous South African novelists of the time, and everything. Same thing. No one can control their senses. No one knows what they are. No one has any knowledge of God, and therefore, there's no stop to the exploitation. So yes, what you're saying is a fact, and it will go on and on and on until people's hearts change. So we are trying to do the topmost revolution, the topmost reformation of cleaning the heart. Now, along the way, we distribute prasad, which is not only food for the soul, it's also food for the body. But our main emphasis is on spiritual renovation. You can't go against the laws of nature and think you're going to make prosperity through political and economic solution. It doesn't happen. You've got to make your peace with the source of all the energy. That's the most intelligent thing to do. Okay? Anything else? Yes.
Thank you so much. I was in Soas during the festival. Mm-hmm. I came across some Rastafarian guys.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of like asked me if have I seen myself as a spirit, so why do I call myself a spirit? So I couldn't really like, because I always hear people saying that you are spirit soul.
Mm-hmm.
But they sort of like asked me, have you seen that you are spirit soul? So I'd like to find out from your side, what would you say if somebody asked a question like that?
Have they seen their mind? Have they seen their intelligence? Have they seen the wind? So many things you haven't seen, but you accept that they exist. Seeing is just one sense out of five. You can experience that you are spirit soul through the process of bhakti yoga, which involves all the senses. By hearing Bhagavatam, you actually experience your spiritual identity. By hearing the Hare Krishna mantra, you experience your spiritual identity. So why seeing? Their seeing is so limited. Cats can see much better than you can see. Can you compete with a cat at night seeing things? No. You can't compete with a dog in hearing sounds. So why should we put so much emphasis on our limited senses, especially seeing, but all our senses are limited. But if the senses are in contact with bhakti, then you've got something else going on. So their presentation to you is simply based on their limited sense perception, and even not even all the senses, just the eyes. If they want to experience the soul, then they should enter the bhakti laboratory and take up the methods. See, explain like that. Don't let them rattle you. Of course, generally, they like to be Rastafarians because then they can smoke marijuana, right? But, huh? Yeah. What's a Rastafarian without marijuana? It's the prasad. Of course, as you saw in Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj's documentary, I think it's Govardhan, you saw the Babaji's, you know, they were, you know, smoking hash and first they would offer it to Shiva and then take it as prasad. So this delusion is everywhere. Whether it's Rastafari or this Fari or that Fari. Everyone simply wants to get intoxicated and vent out their lust. That they call civilization. So what are you going to do about that, economically or politically? You think about it, let me know. I've already been over this back and forth, you know. Yeah. Back and forth, again and again and again. One of our revolutionary heroes was Stokely Carmichael. He was a big revolutionary activist in the USA in the 60s. And then he married a South African singer, Miriam Makeba, and like that. And just spent the rest of his life as a sense gratifier. After speaking so much powerful revolutionary theory, in the end. So, you look at history. Has there ever been a political economic solution?
None.
Oh, you're hoping.
None so far.
None so far. I'm saying you're hoping there'll be in the future. No. Not possible. Because it's a violation of the laws of nature to misuse your valuable human form of life just for making a nice situation in this temporary world. Even if you can do it, which you can't, so what? What have you achieved? Now, if you really want to make a change, you've got to stop the exploitative mentality in people. What is powerful enough to do that? You have to have God-conscious leaders, Krishna-conscious leaders. Otherwise, as soon as they take the top post, they start lining their own pocket. I read Nelson Mandela, he warned, don't let this happen in South Africa. It's happening. I've read, supposedly, who knows what's true or not, but your big chief of police in South Africa, he had cronies in the underworld. Hey, what's the big deal? He's just my friend. What's the problem? It wasn't like I was doing wrong. I just happened to have him as a friend. It made complete sense to him. But it doesn't seem to be making sense with the people. Maybe they will accept it. Well, anyway, he's a good guy. He did good for the revolution, so might have made a mistake, but you know. But during the fight against apartheid, he was in the trenches with us, you know, and so we just overlook these things, you know. Right? What do you say? It's the problem. No one knows how to control their senses. And what should be the reason why you should control your senses?
I should be asking this question.
Yeah, why should you control your senses? The whole goal of civilization is to make money. Get all the products, the Jack Daniels. Some leaders these days are even open about it. Who is this guy in Venezuela, Chavez? Yeah, socialism for the people. He has political rallies of thousands, and he just stands right in front of them. I was told this by an eyewitness, and he's got his young, secretary, and he stands up and he holds out a whiskey bottle. This is our program, whiskey and woman. Yay! And people just, his secretary's here, a little miniskirt on, everything, and he just holds out the whiskey bottle and points to her. This is our political program. Everyone cheers. Yay! So that's very blatant, obviously. But he's just coming out with, with the truth. So, whether before apartheid or after apartheid, do you see any leaders teaching sense control?
No.
Spiritual knowledge?
Very rare.
Recognizing that everything is owned and controlled by the Supreme?
Very rare. Awesome.
Right. So therefore, peace will be very rare. And true prosperity will be very rare. You're always going to see these booms and busts. Looks like everything's going to be fine and prosperous, then crash. Then again, looks like, we're on the way up again, then crash. There's more to passion. We credit situations, political and economic situations, simply when they allow us to preach. So now we can preach more openly, so therefore we give credit to the situation for that purpose. Just like in the former communist countries. Okay, now we can preach there. So we say, okay, in that way things are better. But actually, I know as a fact, because I would do Krishna conscious preaching and organizing underground in former communist countries. During the time of communism, the people were, the devotees were more serious. Now, I don't want those days to come back, but the fact is, I have to tell you the truth, the devotees were more serious because, you know, things were so bad. They just cried out to Krishna. I remember devotees, when we smuggled books into Poland for the first time, like 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas we managed to smuggle into Poland, and devotees were taking them out in the streets to sell them. And it was midwinter, 20 below zero, they were going out. And they were so happy, they were crying, and the tears were freezing to their cheeks. They were so happy. Oh, we've got Bhagavad Gita! And they describe how they would, you know, go into a center of a city, you know, with a backpack on, you know, full of Bhagavad Gitas, and they would, you know, just telling them, got some books here. Rare books from India about Krishna. And do it very clandestine, and then they would tell enough people, and then the devotee would go onto a back street, and you would see, if you were watching in the center of the city, you'd see like 20, 30 people trying to sneak their way, you know, to the back street, you know, looking over their shoulder. And then by the time they met up with the devotee on the back street, there would be a line of 30 people with a month's salary in hand to buy Bhagavad Gita. They were so desperate. They would hand over a month's salary. Anything, give us relief. Please, give us something different. So, still, I say we don't want those circumstances to come again because devotees were harassed, they were persecuted. So let us take very great advantage of the circumstances we have now. If you want to do something for the people, then give them Krishna consciousness. Think how to do it. If you really care, then you become qualified to help them. Then do the necessary. The whole world is full of people who want to love and care without getting any qualification. That's cheap stuff.
My last question,
Maharaj. Yes.
If your assertion is that during the communist days it was people like were easy to preach to, what's made them difficult to preach now?
What do you think made it difficult now? All the conveniences and luxuries of freedom.
But my assertion is that forces at play during that time are the very same forces that I play.
What does it matter? You're going to spend your whole life studying the forces at play. It's going to go on and on and on. What are you going to do about it?
My only concern is the impact that it has on the people you're supposed to preach to.
Yeah, but I'm saying, what are you going to do about it? You can study it till you're, you know, dead in the grave. Or in samadhi. What are you going to do about it, though? You can study, study, study.
I'm afraid, Maharaj, you've just said in less than 20 years' time, we'll run out of the resources that are there for us to use.
Yes.
And sometimes we'll be forced to use the very same, like, uranium stuff, like there's this nuclear energy that the world is made to fly upon. Mm-hmm. But seemingly it's being introduced and it says there are rumors going around. Already there are people who own those mines that produce uranium. By then I'll be forced to use the very same uranium that I'm
getting. You know what the big resource is now that multinationals are buying up? Water. They figured out. In the future. Jai, Haribo.
Hare Krishna. Good to see you.
Happy appearance day to you.
Maharaj.
Haridev was telling me about your wonderful preaching in Soweto.
I'm getting worked over here. Political economic solution. And he's, what you're saying is right. But, you know, this is something I realized years ago. You may understand how the whole economic world political scene is working. What are you going to do about it?
Does it mean Maharaj should be using the very same facilities that, it's not suitable for nature to use them, these fuel emitting substances. But if I have to drive my car, I've got to use petrol and diesel. I mean, I've got the same effect that I'm...
Therefore, make sure you drive your car for Krishna's pleasure.
What difference does it make?
It makes a complete difference.
No, I mean, Maharaj, in terms of the emissions that it gives out.
There'll always be some problem in this world. You'll never get it materially perfect. Therefore, use everything for Krishna's pleasure. You'll never be immaculate in the material sense. I remember, of course, if you compare this to Srila Prabhupada, but when he was preaching in the USA at the beginning of the Hare Krishna movement, and yoga people would come to see him and come to the Sunday feast, and they would see that devotees used white sugar, and so therefore they would refuse to take any of the prasad, and they considered it such a big thing. Of course, I have to say I don't take white sugar for health reasons, but they just made a fanatical point out of it, to such, like this was like a cardinal precept of spiritual life, you understand? So there was a preaching program at a yoga place, and all these young yogis were there, and Prabhupada knew what they were thinking. You know, they brought up the point, you know, white sugar, like this is like the, you know, main part of the doctrine. So Prabhupada had one of his devotees get a chapati and then take a huge amount of, the way he took a huge amount of white sugar and poured it on the chapati, and Prabhupada was like, eat it. Right in front of all these guys. To make the point that the main thing is to offer your food to Krishna. If you overlook that point, what's the use in your focusing on all these other things? You understand? So if you forget Krishna, you'll never have any economic or political balance. You clear out the whites from oppressing you, then your own people oppress you. You clear them out from oppressing you, then the purples come and oppress you. You know, it just goes on and on and on. You can't make a material solution in that way. It's impossible. The laws of nature are stacked against you. You don't recognize who is the source of all energies, you're going to have problems. Who does the energy belong to? What's the use in having honor amongst thieves, you know? Let's steal everything, take it all back to our hideout, and divide it fairly. That is modern civilization. So why should you get hung up on establishing honor amongst thieves? Why don't you stop people from being thieves? Who owns the uranium? Who owns the food? Who owns the water? Yes, so therefore, you make your peace with God. Therefore, Ishopanishad says, Ishobashamidam sarvam. You have a right to use everything if it's just your quota that you need to live for a life of Krishna consciousness. But because everything is owned and controlled by the Supreme. He'll give you what you need, but don't take more. So that you have to teach to the leaders. Now, in a democracy, it can be that the easiest tactic is to make the people Krishna conscious so that they'll want Krishna conscious leaders. And it also is true that if you make a famous person Krishna conscious, they can influence the people. So we try this way, we try that way, through the Krishna conscious process. So I appreciate that you know all these things. I also know all of that stuff. But it's not going to save the situation. I was talking to one political leader. He was the ex-prime minister of New Zealand. And I started telling him things, like just like you said. He kind of like... he was a favorable guy. He loved India, and he had opened one of our temples there in New Zealand while he was prime minister. So I started asking him questions, just like you're asking. And he's kind of... And he looked... Young man, what's a Hare Krishna like you asking me questions like that? And then he began to explain. And he said, yeah, it's all true what you're saying. It's all true. He said, you know, I've something I realized long ago. If you're smart enough to figure this out, become one of us. We're open to it. But most people are too stupid. They don't care. They have their TV, their sports. To let him live like that. But if you are smart enough to figure out all these things, become one of us. Someone has to be in control. I was just, you know. So I used to be idealistic like you. But I realize now that someone has to be in control. If you can figure this out, if you've got that lucid intelligence, we're open. Become one of us. What do you say to that? Oh, you want to become one of them? And he knew a little bit about the Krishna consciousness philosophy, so he said, look, it's not that we're demons. It's just that someone has to be in control. Most people couldn't care less. They've got TV, satellite TV, sports, parties. What do they care? Meanwhile, someone has to control the world. You're welcome to be one of us. Is that right? So this is what's going on. Yes. No material solution. I realized this years ago. All the guys who make all the theories that you quote, I studied under them. And I saw their lives also. Big, big scholars, right? One wrote a book that's still famous. I saw, you know, I just saw, I was reading something a few days ago. The guy is still quoted as an authority. He wrote a book on sugar plantations and exploitation. I studied under him, you know, what, how many years ago was that now? Like 37 years ago. And I know the guy's personal life. It's a complete wreck. Complete wreck. But he's held even now as the authority. So, you're right, but so what? That's the problem. Srila Prabhupada, but he presented the same kind of reasons to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. You know that?
I'm still reading on that.
Yeah, he said. He was in his early 20s. He was part of Gandhi's resistance movement. You know? And so, Prabhupada, in his first meeting with Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, said, wait a minute, who's going to take India seriously until we break free of the British? First, you must have independence. That'd be something I would have said in my university days, too. Probably something you would have said, right? First, kick out the oppressors, and then we can talk about spiritual things. But Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur convinced him, Krishna consciousness is so important, it can't wait for anything. And furthermore, you'll never be independent in this world. You're enslaved by the laws of nature. What do you think about that? Figure out who the real enemy is. That conquers everyone, whether they're rulers or not. They're all conquered by time, the laws of nature. The best thing you can do is to develop a Krishna conscious character and with compassion distribute Krishna consciousness to help the people. Otherwise, this stuff will just go on and on. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.